So my name is Kyra Cabañas, and the title of my talk today is going to be Homage to New York, Jean Tanguy's Destructive Art. I'll be talking principally about a performance that Tanguy did entitled Homage to New York, which actually took place in MoMA's Sculpture Garden in 1960, and I'll give a little background to Tanguy and his work. And then in the course of the lecture, I'll show two films. I'll show one short 5-minute clip from a film about halfway through, and then at the end I'll show another film, both of which actually derive from this performance, so that you get much more visual context and imagery about this performance. So on October 27th, 1960, the French critic Pierre Restanis officially named a group of artists then working in Paris as the New Realists. This nominalist gesture was founded on a handwritten declaration that stated, and I'm reading the manifesto on the left, "The New Realists recognize their collective singularity. New Realism equals new perceptual approaches to the real." Yet despite the claim to a collective identity, the artists who signed the declaration alongside Restanis, including Armand, François Dufresne, Raymond Ahnes, Yves Klein, Marcel Hess, Daniel Spury, Jean Tanguy, and Jacques Villeglé, were neither defined by a coherent style, nor did they have recourse to the same avant-garde strategy, even though they all incorporated consumer objects and new media into their work. And just I want to insert here that the New Realists are very much contemporaries of Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg's as well. They're often kind of seen as the French equivalent of pop art. So just to give you a sense, they're all working in the 1950s and early 1960s. And artists such as Raymond Ahnes and Jacques Villeglé, they very much turn to, you know, everyday subjects and materials. Here, they're torn posters, which they would recontextualize and present as a kind of collage entitled Décollage, an example of which you see on the right. Other artists such as Daniel Spury would glue quotidian and culinary remains to a tabletop and then place it vertically on a wall like a ready-made still life. And this is Spury's Kitchka's Breakfast from 1960, which is actually on view on MoMA's fourth floor now. Other artists such as Armand displayed various products from car headlights to high heel shoes in various vitrines, two examples of which you see here. What is more, the critic Pierre Restanis' formulation of New Realism as a realism that was the direct appropriation of the real was in his writing repeatedly cast in affirmative terms. According to Restanis, these artists delighted in and were happily complicit with France's burgeoning consumer and technological culture at this historical moment. And this is a point I really want to insist on, that the way the critic Pierre Restanis really framed this group was that they were kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky, very much embracing all kind of commercial and industrial developments in France in the 50s and 60s, in the way that pop art is often seen also within these terms. And then I just wanted to highlight this quote by Jean Tanguy, where he says, "I received the label New Realist, although I don't have anything to do with it," to kind of problematize this appellation in terms of his own work. So rather than express an unfettered optimism, what I'd like to consider here today is Jean Tanguy's work, and more specifically, his destructive works, which challenge Restanis' characterization of the artists who formed the group otherwise known as the New Realists. On March 14, 1959, Charles Wilp took a photograph of Jean Tanguy sitting next to a pilot in the cockpit of a Cessna aircraft. Tanguy leans back in his seat, turning in the direction of the photographer. In both hands, he displays fanned-out copies of a handbill with the words Verstatik in German, or Vorstatics in English, printed in the upper right-hand corner. Right here, it's a little hard to see. Written on occasion of his first solo show at the Gallery Schmella in Dusseldorf, the complete text on the handbill reads, and you can read along with me, "Everything moves continuously. Immobility does not exist. Don't be subject to the influence of out-of-date concepts of time. Forget hours, seconds, and minutes. Accept instability. Live in time. Be static with movement. For a static of the present moment, resist the anxious fear to fix the instantaneous, to kill that which is living. Stop insisting on values which cannot but break down. Be free. Live. stop painting time, stop building cathedrals and pyramids that are doomed to fall into ruin. Live in the present, live once more in time and by time for a wonderful and absolute reality. The manifesto was printed on 1,500 bills, and what its content suggests in no uncertain terms, with its assertion that everything moves continuously, is a changed conception of material reality, one that has been given over to a kind of behavioral flux. Here, Tengli reformulates the Heraclitean dictum that the only thing that remains constant is constant change. What is more, the photograph does not necessarily frame movement as the cause of his work. Rather, movement is here repositioned as the effect of multiple relations in which many things come together. The aircraft, the pilot, the artist, the flyer, or the handbill, and the photographer. It is such a movement of parts within a network that Tengli will ultimately explore in relation to the twin developments of the atomic bomb and television. And we'll get to this question of atomic bombs and television a little further on in the lecture. As early as 1954, Tengli produced work that incorporated movement, such as his Meta Milayevich, which you see here, from 1954. This relief, part of an early series known as the Meta Mechanique, was made of cut-out sheet metal in the form of rectangles, evoking the painting of Kazimir Milayevich, from whom the work's title derives. Painted white, see here, the metal forms were set into a black plywood base, while a hidden system of pulleys and cogwheels, which you see on the right, the reverse side of the relief, operated by a small motor, would rotate the forms at different speeds. The relief produces different perceptions within the otherwise unified field of painting due to the form's non-synchronic rotation. And on this point, Tengli would insist, and I'm going to quote Tengli, "It would take at least 10,000 years for that extraordinary machine to make the same composition pass before our eyes," end quote. So the fact that everything turned in non-synchronic relation was a way to almost dynamize painting so that you would not see the same composition unless you were to kind of go back and look at the work 10,000 years in the future. While the works were initially dubbed automats by Tengli, the metamechanic reliefs have little to do with the conceptual underpinnings of automation per se, insofar as automation suggests absolute control over the machine, or alternatively suggests a self-regulating machine as popularized in the cybernetic discourses of the time. But as art historian Pamela Lee has described, contemporary anxieties around automation did find their expression in Tengli's subsequent metamatics, or his drawing and painting machines. These were first exhibited the following year, in 1955. Here, Tengli created iron constructions made up of abstract shapes. Within each, he included an easel-like component on which a piece of paper could be secured. So here you have the easel-like component and then the paper attached with clips. Then a wire arm that could hold a pen was attached to the surface. And here you have the wire arm. And once a coin was dropped into the small slot on the work, the pen would draw on the paper surface, its fits and starts, producing an abstract work. In this way, the metamatic dramatizes the foreclosure of artistic expression. And to this, Tengli would further elaborate another challenge to the stability of art, ultimately through its destruction. And I just want to say that also on the fourth floor, there's now a little gallery dedicated to new realist work. So you could see work by Tengli, also by Armand, the work I showed before by Daniel Sperry. And you don't actually have this machine on view, but you do have some of the abstract paintings produced by the machine on view on the fourth floor. It's actually at the bottom of the stairs when you go from the fifth to the fourth floor. So if you haven't been up there to see it, I think there are like four or five of these works currently on view. So Tengli's first experiment in destruction took place with his homage to New York, a machine measuring approximately 27 by 30 feet and rigged to perform for half an hour and ultimately self-destruct on March 17, 1960, in the Museum of Modern Art's Sculpture Garden. And just what I'm showing you here is just a sketch of the machine, and then again, this is a fragment of the machine that we'll see actually perform in the film, and this is also currently on view at MoMA as well. In collaboration with Billy Kluver, a Bell Labs engineer, Tingley's work was built over the course of 3 weeks. He bought old motors on Canal Street, a weather balloon, bicycle wheels, and traveled with Kluver to a Newark dump, acquiring material for the machine. He also purchased an old piano, onto which he mounted arms made up of bicycle parts, and also attached a Metamatic, one of his painting machines, which I previously showed. A 25-foot steel tube would support a weather balloon, while other moving contraptions included two small carriages powered by motors. And this is an image of the work as it's usually reproduced in catalogs, so it gives you a sense of all of the various contraptions in it. Here's the weather balloon and all of the different parts. And it was painted white because the performance took place in the evening, and that way everything could be much seen in the darkness. But Tingley's homage to New York was not just physical. An adressograph machine had become a percussion instrument with cans and a big bell, not to mention the prepared piano that was reconfigured to play. Tingley had also asked Kluver to find the strongest stinks or smells in order to place them in various bottles that would ultimately topple and break. What is more, nothing was to be touched during the operation of the machine. As Kluver, in his detailed account of the performance, explains, and I quote, "There must have been on the order of 100 different operations," end quote. And I'm going to show the video now, and just before going to the video, I want to say that this kind of collaboration between artists and engineers is really kind of coming into being at this time in the 1960s. By the time that Tingley is working, basically 6 years later, Robert Rauschenberg would also collaborate with Billy Kluver and found Experiments in Art and Technology. So it just gives you a sense that this kind of reciprocity between artists and scientists and artists and engineers was very much part of the cultural ethos at the time. So this is Breaking It Up at the Museum by Tingley's friend D.A. Pennebaker. So we'll watch about the first 5 minutes of this film. Okay, so as you probably noticed in the video, things didn't really go according to plan. The piano did not work correctly. In the end, just playing what Billy Kluver described as three sad notes. And 3 minutes into the performance, the Metamatic failed to paint. As the machine continued to fail to perform as planned, Tingley, as Kluver explains, and I quote, "let photographers take pictures, posing like an actor," end quote. In the 18th minute, the fire extinguisher was to go off. It did not. In the 20th minute, the metal had melted and the structure sagged. I think you kind of got this. At 23 minutes, the carriage came out from under the piano, running into the correspondent from Paris Match, and then into the NBC sound equipment, but it missed the garden's pond as planned, so it was planned to kind of, you know, go into the pond and commit suicide, metaphorically, which it didn't. When the performance came to a close, the audience was able to take bits and pieces as souvenirs, and basically what you see on view upstairs at MoMA is a kind of souvenir of the performance. And we might talk about its status. And in the end, the bottles broke and the garden stank for 2 days. So in terms of the work's reception, it is perhaps tellingly caught between two radically different views. So in terms of the contemporary press and reception, on the one hand, you know, the press hailed it as a gadget to end all gadgets. Some critics considered the homage also a critical comment on the threat of nuclear catastrophe, while others deemed it pure entertainment. So it thus evoked both somber and amusing responses, including lunatic show, gesture of independence against machines, black tie Dada, and Calvin Tompkins, critic for The New Yorker at the time, dubbed it a doomsday machine. For MoMA Sculpture Garden and live audience, Tingley would move on to even bigger acts of destruction. Indeed, given Tingley's increased penchant for explosives, television ultimately afforded the possibility for an even greater spectacle with an audience at a physical remove. And I'm just going to show you this quote by Tingley: "You cannot expect the world to end the way you want it to." The color broadcast begins with a close-up of Tingley framed against the Nevada sky. This scene begins the documentary report on Tingley's Study for an End of the World No. 2, which was aired on NBC on April 6, 1962, as part of the award-winning David Brinkley's Journal. One year earlier, Tang Li had produced a similar self-destroying machine, Study for an End of the World No. 1, in the outdoor garden of the Louisiana Museum near Copenhagen. But this time, he was approached by NBC to explicitly stage an event for their program. The footage continues with shots of Tang Li scavenging for potential materials in a desolate junkyard. In voiceover, David Brinkley explains, and I quote, "He finds beauty in these things because they are the refuse of our age, used, lived with, and discarded, symbols of our prosperity and materialism," end quote. Holding a used and disfigured plastic doll, Tang Li exclaims to his partner and fellow artist Nike de Sanfal, and I quote, "Nike, look, the end of the world." She responds, "Boom." The following sequence cuts to downtown Las Vegas with images of gamblers and gambling machines, with Brinkley ultimately describing the city as a showcase of gaudy newness. Tang Li and Sanfal eventually arrive at the Flamingo Motel. In the motel parking lot, Tang Li had built an 8-foot-high fence, enclosing, as it were, an outdoor studio for the construction of his work. On the fence's exterior, a large sign reads, and you can read it along with me, "The End of the World." Within this enclosure, noted Swiss sculptor Jean Tang Li is building an infernal machine which on March 21st will blow itself to pieces. 12 minutes into the broadcast, 7 vehicles carry the work to the desert. "Everything is going okay," Brinkley explains, "except that Tang Li was running late. Meanwhile, the police was also there to see that the end of the world came in an orderly way." So here you see the two police officers, and this is actually the work behind. As the broadcast of Tang Li's study continues, we see the shelters that are constructed for NBC cameras and other press attachés, who included photographers and reporters from Life, Saturday Evening Post, the Associated Press, and the United Press International. Finally, with metal hat and goggles, Tang Li is shown at the control panel, which is connected to wires that run to a generator and along the desert ground to the work's various component parts. Brinkley explains, and I quote, "Each button on being pushed was to cause something to happen," end quote. And it's at this point that we finally see the work in its entirety. And so what we see is basically this orange kind of plywood monochrome. This is a rotating sign of a horn of plenty. Then we have a refrigerator on this large pole. And on this little black structure here, there's actually a toilet. And this is a blue water tank, which is actually the first element to let out puffs of smoke in the broadcast. And it's kind of interesting, I mean, for me in particular, also because the way that TV kind of flattens images, that particularly these two elements, the orange monochrome and the blue water tank, I mean, look like kind of monochromatic paintings. I mean, they're kind of engaging, I think, in a way with a certain iconography of modernist painting, in the way that perhaps the toilet sitting on this pedestal might be evoking the work of Marcel Duchamp in his 1917 Fountain when he presented a urinal at a salon in New York. So the study's explosions explicitly presented an iconography of nuclear destruction while mining the historical test ground setting that the Nevada desert represents. What is more, the fact that nuclear destruction had been refashioned as a kind of spectacular entertainment in Europe and the United States would not have been lost on the artist. In the United States, beginning in January 1951, an average of one bomb every 3 weeks was detonated over the course of 12 years, totaling 235 bombs. The site, not far from where Tang Li produced his study, was designated the Nevada Proving Grounds. Moreover, Tang Li's study was broadcast almost 10 years after the first broadcast of a bomb test. On April 22, 1952, 200 reporters were invited to gather on a mound of volcanic rock on the edge of the Yucca Lake, 10 miles from the bomb test site. Describing that particular blast, one journalist wrote, and I quote, "You put on the dark goggles, turn your head, and wait for the signal. You brace yourself against the shock wave that follows an atomic explosion, end quote. Not only were most Americans kept safe in their living rooms, but in the wake of the 1952 broadcast, the Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce issued calendars listing the times of the bomb detonations, as well as the best places from which to see them. These two images I'm showing you are just images from that first test that was recorded then to be subsequently televised. And I just wanted to kind of re-emphasize this point that then it became very much, you know, a kind of tourist destination to go to Las Vegas and go to a particular site and be able to watch the blast from a certain distance. But also that the Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce even went so far as to organize a Miss Atomic Bomb beauty contest. And so if you notice that this is actually Lee Merlin, who is the most famous Miss Atomic Bomb from 1957, but you know, you see her outfit reproduces the form of a mushroom cloud. So with his study for An End of the World, Tingley points to how destruction could be repackaged as entertainment, and also anticipates how artistic production would increasingly become part of the culture industry, inhabiting its mode of distribution and image production, in this case, television. But, as with his homage to New York, The End of the World failed to end as planned. Among other errors, the AC motor, which was supposed to pull this small wagon into this shopping cart filled with toys, ultimately missed its target. And there are various moments where things are supposed to run into one another and nothing runs in. And even a moment when Tingley has to actually go physically into the work and then detonate some of the explosives. What was also not stated explicitly in David Brinkley's broadcast, but is recorded actually in the work's print reception, is that the single diesel generator did not have enough power to operate both the machine and the television cameras, so that in the end, Tingley opted for his machine over the cameras, and consequently, as one review explains, and I quote, the cameras were unable to record a lot of exciting events, end quote. Study for An End of the World trades in an image of catastrophe, but also, and for me this is crucial, it inscribes catastrophe within the commodity network system itself, revealing the media's fragility through the lack of electric power. And I think what's also quite interesting, I mean, if we think of this art historically, and the moment when Tingley is doing this in March 1962, this is before pop art really becomes the new thing in the United States. Pop art very much becomes canonized in the wake of a show at the Sydney Janus Gallery in October, November 1962. So this is really almost half a year prior to the kind of emergence of pop as the dominant aesthetic in the United States. So if Tingley revealed the media's precariousness through a study that failed to end, be recorded, and ultimately broadcast as planned, today contemporary artists instead work more precisely to show how the media does not just reproduce, but can actually produce events. And so I'd like to show you a video now of some contemporary artists. This is a video that was produced last year in 2007, and then I'll talk a little bit about it once I show it. So. I'm just going to let the video, because the internet seems to be going a little slow, I'm just going to let it keep going because you've seen the principal part of it, which is actually available on YouTube. So this was produced by the guerrilla artist Czech group known as Sitohoven, and the video was actually piped into Czech television's CT2 channel on a Sunday morning in June 2007. As we see in the video, viewers were privy to a view of the Czech countryside, when all of a sudden a white flash is followed by the image of a rising mushroom cloud. But what I'd like to emphasize in contrast to Tingley's study is that the work's effectiveness in terms of this video really derives from the shift that we've subsequently experienced from an analog to a digital age. Indeed, Sitohoven cleverly probes what it might mean for the televisual public to ultimately react to a catastrophe that, in the end, never really happened. So this, you know, difference between Tingley very much insisting on the realness of that, you know, performance in the desert, whereas these artists very much kind of mining the reality effect of the media in order to produce something that was basically a simulation. So that's the end of my talk. I have another film that I'd like to show you all, but if you have any questions for the moment, or I can go ahead and show the next film, which is a film by Robert Breer. Yes?
He compared to Rube Goldberg, which also made, I guess, I don't know if it was called destructive art then, but it was made from parts of different machines, and they did work.
But they were functioning machines.
Right, but he made them out of old parts, found.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there's a difference in terms of the end effect. I mean, for Tingley, it was really always about... I mean, actually, these are the last... I think Study for the End of the World is the kind of last auto-destructive work he does. But it was about somehow the machine kind of living out its life, right? And then ultimately collapsing. I mean, failure...
And so none of his machines work?
No, later ones do. I mean, you can go to the Pompidou and see... machines that are, you know, much more functioning, but it's always a kind of parody on the seamlessness of machine operations. And these ones, particularly from, you know, 1960, beginning with Homage to New York and ending with Study for an End of the World number 2, all kind of, insist on the kind of failure, you know, where he's like, you know, the end of the world, you know, fails to happen as planned, that he's already kind of anticipating a kind of unraveling of what might be a machine's predictive capacities in terms of the gears all working
so
the same way.
So the Goldberg machines were made for fun or like cartoonish, or did he have any other meaning?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know the work that well, so I don't think that I could actually speak to that with any kind of authoritative claim, except to kind of mark the distinction between, you know, the destruction and the kind of functioning capacity. I mean, machine aesthetic in general is quite big at this time. You also have another artist, Nicolas Schoeffer, in France, who would build cybernetic machines as well. But those were also fully functioning and operating. I mean, they're much more, I would say, technophilic in terms of embracing machine and cybernetic technology, whereas Tingley is playful, but I think it's still there's still a critique there in some ways. Is there another question, or shall I go ahead and show the film and then we can come back to questions? The film's about 7-8 minutes, and you'll see it's by Robert Breer, who is also a filmmaker in his own right, and you'll see that he's taken the footage from Homage to New York and almost created a kind of collage-like film. So we'll see this kind of collage apparition of Tingley at the beginning, and then that'll kind of close the film at the end. So we'll go ahead and play that now. Okay, so that was the film by Robert Breer. Are there any questions? Before any other questions?
Is it true that he painted the snow black for that performance? Did I read that right?
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that. He painted the snow black and then the structure white. I know he painted the structure white, and that from what my understanding is that it was kind of a last minute decision, like, oh no, it's going to be 6:30 to 7 and nobody's going to see the, you know, metal in the darkness.
Okay.
So... And what I find really astonishing is also, I mean, obviously the work is in flames, right? I mean, we probably wouldn't have this in MoMA's sculpture garden as a potential performance today because of various security restrictions and measures. Yes, you have a question.
This was my question. Could we ever do that today?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking with Emma about this prior. No, I mean, I think that, well, maybe on a small scale. But also in the 1960s, I mean, MoMA was quite a place for kind of avant-garde and progressive performances. Yayoi Kusama, who is a Japanese artist, I don't remember the year, but she did a nude in the garden where there was everybody was like naked lounging around, and I don't really see that happening today either, unfortunately. But yes. Yes, but the visitors aren't. That would be the difference.
Maybe next year.
Maybe next year, exactly. Any other questions? No? All right, well, we've reached the end of the time. Thank you very much.